supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. U.S. Senator Bob Menendez was back in federal court in Newark today, day two of his corruption trial. The New Jersey Democrat and his wealthy friend are each facing around a dozen counts of bribery, conspiracy, and fraud. Prosecutors say Menendez traded government favors for free flights and foreign trips from Florida eye doctor Salomon Melgen. WHYY's Joe Hernandez was in court today, and Joe, we're hearing the judge dress down prosecutors today. Is that so?
He really did, Dave. This is Judge William H. Walls, and he really let attorneys have it at one point. It happened during the testimony of the very first witness. She was an FBI analyst involved in the investigation into Menendez. And at one point, Walls sent the jury back out into the jury room. He told the witness to leave the courtroom, and he told prosecutors essentially that, I mean, he used this phrase. He said, "It seems like you're playing games right now." He said he didn't want this to become a tabloid trial, and what he took issue with was prosecutors asking about a hotel room that Melgen booked for Menendez for a trip to Paris in 2010, and whether Menendez asked for a room that was a little bit more expensive than another room. Walls said, quote, "Whether these defendants engaged in bribery does not depend on whether the senator chose a more expensive room. We're not talking about the Days Inn. We're talking about very upscale lodging in Paris." And Dave, it seemed like he was worried that the details that prosecutors were getting into, they might try to be sensationalizing events, and that could influence the jury.
And so how did attorneys respond to that dressing down?
Well, Prosecutor Peter Kosky tried to defend his strategy, I should say, to not much avail with the judge. He said that Menendez realized that the high cost of these hotel rooms he wouldn't be able to afford, and so he induced Melgen to pay for them, essentially setting up this bribe. Judge Wall called that ridiculous. He said the prosecutor was making an unfair logical inference, and he used the phrase, "You're trying to jump over your own shadow." Wall also told the defense team, I should note, that the same standard will apply to them.
That was the only witness jurors heard from today, and that followed the end of opening arguments.
Right. So today was the end of opening arguments. The attorney for Salomon Melgen finished his opening argument today. And he continued to try to play down the idea that this house in the Dominican Republic, where prosecutors say Melgen put up Menendez on these luxury trips, was really not much of a luxury resort at all. He said it was a simple family home that Salomon Melgen lived in with his wife and children. He also referenced prosecutors' opening statements when they said that friends can bribe each other. This is defense attorney Kirk Ogroski, and he said that friendship was a defense for bribery because true friends wouldn't bribe each other. And he also picked up on a thread started yesterday by Menendez's defense attorney saying that there's no evidence that these two men had any agreement to trade gifts for political favors.
Joe, is there a sense of what's expected when the trial resumes Monday?
Well, prosecutors started with this FBI analyst who was testifying to the trip to Paris. She had investigated emails between Menendez and some of his staffers and a friend, and credit card records and American Express points. So it's possible that the prosecution is going to start off their case talking about the gifts that were given to Menendez and then move later on to official actions that he took. But even today, I mean, in cross-examination, we got a bit of a taste of how the defense is going to react to the prosecution. Defense attorney Abby Lowell noted in his cross-examination, he was saying there's no evidence here. There's nothing in these emails that shows that there was any quid pro quo.
Tangential, perhaps, to the court proceedings, there's the issue of Menendez's role in the Senate. Now, will he be able to return to Washington if important votes are held during the trial?
Well, right. So he's been indicted, but he is still in the Senate. And these days, politically, the Senate is quite close. The health care bill failed by only one vote in the Senate. So votes can matter. Now, his defense team asked the judge to not hold any proceedings on days when there are important votes in the Senate. The judge said, "No, I wouldn't do that for other people who have jobs, and I'm not going to do it for you." So the senator will have to choose whether he wants wants to be at his trial or whether he wants to be in D.C. if indeed there are important votes.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Dave.
WHYY's Joe Hernandez reporting from the courthouse in Newark, New Jersey. Last night, we spoke to Newsworks Down the Shore blogger Justin Osiello, who was down a different shore at the time in San Juan, Puerto Rico, with Hurricane Irma approaching. We checked back today to see how he and the island fared.
At 8 p.m. last night, Irma's eye made its closest approach to San Juan, about 50 miles to the north. It's hard to describe the sensation. Briny rain through the roof humidity and fits and spurts of wind gusts, some over 74 miles per hour, and that's hurricane strength.
Though more than a million residents are without power, overall, damage to the island was not severe.
Most of Puerto Rico, with the exception of Culebra and Vieques, two offshore islands to the east, missed Irma's wrath last night. I surveyed the beach areas of San Juan this morning, and damage appears to be minor to moderate. The most common damage I saw includes downed trees, branches, and power lines. I did not see any serious structural damage or any evidence of tidal flooding. In fact, there's not much standing water from the rain on the streets at all.
The storm is now on a collision course with the Turks and Caicos Islands, the Bahamas, and then potentially making landfall somewhere in Florida. A Philadelphia police officer who shot a fleeing suspect in the back during a routine traffic stop will be fired for violating several departmental policies. Details from WHYY's Dana DeFilippo.
Officer Ryan Pownall was taking a family to the Special Victims Unit on June 8th when he saw David Jones illegally riding a dirt bike on a North Philadelphia street. He decided to stop him, and that was his first mistake, Police Commissioner Richard Ross says. An officer shouldn't detour from his assigned task. But Ross says Pownall made other mistakes. He didn't tell police radio he was stopping Jones. He failed to call for backup when he discovered Jones had a gun. And after Jones dropped his gun and ran away, the officer violated policy by shooting Jones, even though he no longer posed an immediate danger, Ross says.
We ask police officers to deal with dangerous situations that most people can neither appreciate nor understand. However, this does not relieve us of our responsibility to adhere to our policies and our training. And it does not mean that we shouldn't be held accountable for our actions.
Attorney David Radovsky says firing an officer for an on-duty shooting is very uncommon, both in Philadelphia and nationally. He applauds the move, but he cautions that police discipline often doesn't stick.
I think the police commissioner has made the right decision, but of course the officer can now, in effect, appeal that dismissal through an arbitration process in Pennsylvania. There are scores of officers who've been disciplined by the department, either with suspensions or dismissals for, in some cases, very egregious misconduct, who've been placed back on the force as a result of arbitration.
Jones's mother, Doretha Crosby, was happy Pownall will be fired, but she also wants him criminally charged.
It's good news. It's just half of the work is done. I just want them to do the rest of their job. I hope the general attorney do his job and arrest this cop. I want this cop arrested for murder. What he did, he murdered my son. He needed to be arrested for it.
A spokesman for State Attorney General Josh Shapiro says the investigation is ongoing. He declined to say when it will wrap up. Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
The Trump administration is drastically reducing funding for Affordable Care Act outreach. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman has more on how local groups are responding.
The budget for the Navigator program, which funds workers who help folks jump through all the hoops to sign up for insurance, will be cut almost in half, from $62 million to $36 million. And the Affordable Care Act's budget for commercials, billboards, and more will be slashed from $100 million to $10 million. Christina Miller works with Public Health Management Corporation. Last year, her organization received almost $400,000 to pay for navigators and outreach. This year, they don't know how much money they're getting, but they do know that it will be less. She says people who aren't tech savvy and those who have limited English proficiency will be affected the most. In Philadelphia, that includes lots of Latino and Southeast Asian immigrants.
My fear simply is that people won't enroll.
The Trump administration says less publicity is needed because the ACA has been operating since 2014. But Miller says more people will likely go without health insurance and care next year.
Potentially that means that you know, we revert back to this system where individuals are accessing emergency department services instead of seeing primary care physicians.
She says her team is still evaluating how to move forward in light of the budget cuts. Maggie Norris-Bent, who works at Westside Family Healthcare in Delaware, says even 4 years into Obamacare, it's not well understood.
A lot of people are confused still, and I think that it's very short-sighted to assume that people know what's happening.
Norris-Bent's organization is planning more outreach events, publicizing that this year the enrollment period is shorter than usual, from November 1st to December 15th. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
So-called stop-and-go convenience stores sell snacks, cigarettes, and alcohol. But for decades in Philadelphia, neighbors have complained that customers buying booze often don't go far enough away from the store afterwards, instead choosing to drink in public. State lawmakers are trying to change that. But as WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, a group of North Philly residents isn't waiting for a political solution before taking a stand.
It's just before 2 p.m., and about a dozen neighbors are waiting for the start of a pub crawl outside of a stone-and-brick church in the Sharswood section of North Philly. But there's no drinking on today's itinerary. Instead, the group wants to have a series of face-to-face conversations with the owners of several nearby stop-and-goes, businesses they think are driving down the quality of life in an already struggling neighborhood by skirting state law. Across the street from the church, a handful of older men are carousing by a car parked at the far end of an otherwise empty lot. Pastor William Brauner shakes his head. His back is turned to them, but he doesn't need to see the group to know what's happening. Public drinking is routine here.
My people try to come in or go out from church, and there's people harassing them because they're drunk or people laid out in front of the streets.
And people like Brauner point to the stop-and-goes as the source of the problem. At Penn Stake, the first stop on the pub crawl, two women stand behind a long counter shielded by plexiglass. On the back wall, a pair of refrigerated cases are packed with all kinds of beer and malt liquor. Nearby is a stove that doesn't look like it's getting much use. There's a separate seating area across from the counter, but it's behind a locked door. Stephanie Ridgway, one of the pub crawl's organizers, lets the employees know that's not okay.
If you're serving alcohol, you have to have seating. So we'd like to have a seat, we'd like to have a menu, and we'd like to order a beer. And if you don't have that, that's a violation.
The goal here isn't to shut down Penn Stake or any of the other stop-and-goes on the pub crawl. Ridgway and others want these businesses to be better neighbors. To her, that starts with them following the letter of their state-issued restaurant licenses and stronger enforcement if they don't. Ridgway says she understands the stop-and-go owners are trying to earn a living.
I understand that completely. But what we need is to have some humanity along with it, because money is not everything.
Stop-and-goes are overseen by the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board. PLCB spokeswoman Elizabeth Brussell says these shops need seating for at least 30 people, and they have to sell food. That may seem obvious for a restaurant to sell something to eat, but Brussell says the bar is pretty low.
You know, a minimum offering of a hot dog per person or chips or some sort of minimal food like that has been proven to meet that requirement.
While all of this may seem nitpicky, Ridgway and Brauner say enforcing these details could help move more of the drinking inside the stop-and-goes and off the streets of their neighborhood. State lawmakers agree. Recently, the House overwhelmingly passed a bipartisan bill that would beef up the state liquor laws that apply to stop-and-goes. For example, it would require those with restaurant licenses to not only have seats for patrons, but seating that's always available, not behind locked doors or chairs stacked up in a corner. It would also step up enforcement of those rules. Bill Chow owns a stop-and-go in the city's West Oak Lane section. He's also a member of the Asian American Licensed Beverage Association of Philadelphia. He says there's only so much stop-and-go owners can do if their customers choose to drink their purchases outside the store in public.
I mean, you put the onus on us. I mean, somebody's going to get hurt. You know, we go outside, what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to... You know, we ask them to leave and they don't want to leave. So are we supposed to fight them or something along that line?
When store owners call the police, Chow says customers loitering outside usually scatter but come back when they know the coast is clear. But Ridgway and her crew argue business owners could do more to make their stop-and-goes more neighborhood friendly. At the second stop on their pub crawl, Ridgway tries to drive that point home to the store's co-owners.
If you were out on a day shopping and you wanted to stop and have a meal, would you come to this establishment? You wouldn't. This would be the last place that you would think to do business. And this is why it's important that we bring some light to all of the businesses on this block.
The bill cracking down on stop and goes still needs to clear the Senate. Backers hope to get it to Governor Tom Wolf's desk later this year. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Tomorrow is the kickoff of 14 months of commemorative events along the Ben Franklin Parkway for its 100th anniversary. Let's look back and then ahead with Philadelphia Inquirer architectural critic Inga Safran. Inga, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's go back 100 years, inspired apparently by a famous boulevard in Paris.
Yes, the Champs-Élysées. This was a time in American history when cities were booming and millions of immigrants were pouring into cities like Philadelphia, and there were crowded tenements and unsanitary conditions, and the city felt, like many cities, that it wanted to beautify the city, and it would create a grand boulevard connecting City Hall to Fairmount Park. And it basically tore down about 1,300 buildings in this northwest quadrant of Center City and created the parkway. A lot of cities were trying to put in beautiful infrastructure improvements, and the parkway was part of that.
Wide and airy works to the detriment in 2017 to the extent that it's a challenge to traverse it by foot.
By foot, yes, it's a challenge. So you notice it's called a parkway. And, you know, this was the beginning of the automobile and of these beautiful landscaped, wide, safe streets. And so for motorists, it was a great innovation. I think because it wasn't thought through as clearly, you know, they didn't really deal with this issue or think about this issue of, well, what's it going to be like for a human being to walk the mile from City Hall to the Art Museum? They had, you know, very ambitious ideas about the cultural organizations that would be located there. There were originally plans for many more cultural buildings. A lot of institutions didn't want to move there. And really, from a very early moment, they didn't have full agreement about what this boulevard should be. And I think that's the source of its problems today.
That lack of accord from the onset.
Right, right. And I write about this in my column, which is online now, and in tomorrow's Inquirer, is, you know, they're just, they didn't really have a clear vision of what they wanted to be. I mean, Champs-Élysées is a mixed-use boulevard with gracious apartment buildings and cultural institutions and cafes and shops, and it's very lively. Our Champs-Élysées is kind of the opposite, although, there have been some improvements in recent years, and you see people jogging and walking their dogs. But, you know, it could be so much better.
Let me put you on the spot that you have been assessing the Philadelphia architectural scene as a veteran now for some time. In addition to amenities like a bathroom and a cafe, what might you prioritize for either that portion or the entire parkway?
I think at the very least, we could have some kind of cafe or public space on Van Collin Field, which does have a lot of room to accommodate a small pavilion-like building. Another thing we could, you know, we should have more art along the parkway as well.
Above and beyond the Frank Rizzo sculpture.
Yeah. and the Rocky statue at either end. They're, you know, bracketing the parkway. One of the things I really liked in this 1999 plan that was done by the Central Philadelphia Development Corp was they proposed to consolidate the express and local lanes, which is more like the Champs-Élysées, which is just, you know, a wide street in the middle with wide sidewalks. I thought that was a really great idea. And again, those sidewalks would have to be activated with, you know, uses that gave people a reason to be there. But I would love to see it as a more, you know, gracious, inhabited boulevard with still lots of green and park space.
Inga, thanks so much for offering perspective once again on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure, Dave. Nice to be here.
Philadelphia Inquirer architectural critic Inga Safron. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. The annual Fringe Festival begins in Philadelphia today with over 150 different theater productions, often performed in unusual spaces. Two longtime veterans of Philadelphia theater, Tom Weaver and Brenna Geffers, collaborated to create their own company called DieCast, which will debut during the festival. They're staging an experimental version of the Shakespeare play Pericles at the Rotunda in West Philadelphia. It's a large, domed building with notoriously difficult acoustics. WHYY's Peter Crimmins visited them during rehearsal.
We were trying to think of the space as an instrument itself and finding the way that the sounds and the text can use the acoustics of the space in a new way. So it's going to take us a little bit of time, and that's what we're doing today, is literally testing out what our sounds, our breath, our bodies sound like in the space so that we can make it a sort of the starring central character of the work that we do.
I'm Tom Weaver, and I'm the co-founder of DieCast.
I'm Brenna Geffers, and I'm the other co-founder of DieCast.
We're at the Rotunda in West Philly in rehearsal for, I think, our first day in the space for our production of Pericles.
It was a church a long time ago, but not for a long time. It's beautiful. It is a huge, crumbling, white space. Looks like old bones sort of shedding another layer of marrow.
It's certainly challenging, especially for Shakespeare, but we're working very hard on it right now to figure that out.
Volume doesn't necessarily mean better in this space. The louder doesn't necessarily mean clearer. What does your body need to do to create the right sound in this space? We're about an hour and a half in, and I think we're already making some good discoveries.
That's Brenna Geffers, who, with Tom Weaver, created a new version of Shakespeare's Pericles at the Rotunda in West Philadelphia. Their new theater company debuts this weekend as part of the Fringe Festival. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.